You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. And I'm excited to talk about how superficiality won the story of the separation of looks and substance. And part of what inspired me to talk about this week was the HBO documentary called Fake Famous. I'm not sure if you've watched it yet. It's pretty interesting. It dives into a lot of the subject matter I've been talking about over the past few years. And I will be talking about it. I don't believe I'll be spoiling it because it's kind of like a documentary. So it probably just will interest you to watch it even more if you haven't already. And if you have, then this is like a cool commentary, you know, that you might enjoy. So Fake Famous is a documentary about this guy who apparently, I think he's like in the social media world. He's like a marketer or something. And he had been kind of defending a lot of the negative arguments about social media for a while, but I guess something tipped him over and made him realize, like, maybe this thing that I'm like defending all the time actually isn't as harmless as I'm making it out to be. And so he decides to, you can tell he's really bothered by America's obsession for fame in particular, especially aimless fame, like wanting to be famous without any particular acknowledgement of like a talent or skill, but, you know, just pure celebutante kind of desire that many young people have, and how most young people right now, I think the number one pursued job in the country is a YouTuber, is an influencer, and kind of going into like, what's up with that, and can we artificially create fame? And that's what they try to do. So I of course love this topic, because if you read my book, you know that I open it up talking about how the tippy point of my journey into social media started with the same desire, a very a poorly thought out desire of wanting to be famous because I thought that was just like what you were supposed to do. I thought it would solve problems. And I also talk very openly in the book about how, you know, how wrong that was and how unfortunate it was and is for so many young people to want to build a brand online and want to like be popping on social media for no reason. And how it's important that I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting, you know, recognition or to be acknowledged for things that you do. But when I see young people wanting fame because they think it's going to solve their problem, then obviously we can see that that might be a bigger issue. So that gets explored, and you kind of just, you feel for these people who are talking, and you're like, wow, they show kind of the sickness all permeated throughout social media and the incentives around social media. So anyway, they pick these three people, and the part that I thought was the most fascinating and what inspired me to want to talk about this today was he essentially picks three people and then he gives them like a mini makeover, and then he wants to see that if he can buy them followers and if buying them followers will give them attention, like legitimate followers and the ability to get stuff from brands, like, you know, merch and stuff like that. So it's kind of weird and creepy, and it's good, but it's good to watch, right? So he gets these followers for these accounts, and they basically go into how, they basically ask this question of like, what's stopping Instagram and Twitter from wanting less bots, right? We get this memo coming out from social media usually that they don't want bots, they're trying to clean up bots, they discourage bots. But the argument the documentary was making was that people who buy bots and fake followers actually help Instagram and Twitter because, you know, the big mega social media platforms have investors that, and they have, you know, quarterly recaps where they have to go in and talk about their earnings and their growth, right? And when people on your platform are buying fake engagement for your platform, you get to use that data when you go in for those earnings reports and say, hey, like, look how much our platform has grown, you know? And the guy in the documentary goes into how mathematically a lot of this doesn't make sense. Like, he talks about how is it possible for, you know, something like, how can 1 million people have 1 million followers each? Like, are there even this many people in the world? You know, like, going into this question, like, let's actually start to crunch numbers. And how there's this kind of black market running on Instagram and Twitter and the main social media sites that really work in favor for those sites. Because basically, you know, you can buy ads directly from that platform and use those ads to kind of promote your posts or pump your posts. Or you can go to a third-party bot platform and buy those bots. But ultimately, again, those platforms benefit from you doing that because then they get to use that fake engagement to, you know, assure their investors that everything's A-okay and things are just growing. It's funny because, again, like, there's only so many people in the world. So, I mean, like, wow, that just set me off because I was like, I made an episode a few episodes back about the attention economy. And we have gotten to a point, y'all, where not only are we harvesting eyeballs and attention, but we are harvesting fake eyeballs right now. Like, what I've realized these bots companies are is they're just eyeball farms, like fake eyeball farms. So, like, Instagram is a real, you know, for lack of a better term, eyeball farm, right? Because your eyes are really there. But then there's people who have legitimate, like, huge companies just creating the image of, just the symbol of, not the substance of, these eyeballs. Just the metric of, not the substance of. And that's what I want to talk about today. Because I just, we got fake eyeballs running the attention economy. That is the epitome of a bubble. Okay, so when we're talking about money economies, when we trade our money, what we do to encourage people to create wealth, and again, if you're listening to this, I would advise you listen to the money versus wealth episode first, so this makes even more sense. But one of the ways we encourage people to generate actual wealth from the planet is to create credit, right? Credit is, it's credit, right? Credit is like someone giving you money and trusting you with money and trusting that you will return that money. It's like a loan, right? But the point is that credit is almost, it's another dimension of like how unreal money is. If that, like, what I'm trying to say is that money is like directly money, but credit is kind of like floating money, if hopefully that makes a little sense. The only reason why I'm bringing that up is because your eyeballs are like the money, and then the fake eyeballs are like the credit. Like, it's not really there. It's there to, it's been like created out of something, out of wealth that is not there. I hope I'm not confusing folks, but the point I'm making is that fake eyeballs is pretty crazy to think about. Like, this attention economy at the scale it's at, I would bet, cannot even depend on the actual eyeballs that are on the planet. It needs credit eyeballs. It needs fake eyeballs. Like, it needs a loan on eyeballs that don't exist. And companies are using those credit eyeballs to say, yeah, we're doing good, you know? So maybe a way to make it clear is, like, say you don't have any cash, but you have a $5,000 credit card, you know, and someone says, how much money do you have, you know? And you would say, I have $5,000, but you don't. You have $5,000 of credit, which is essentially debt. So hopefully that clarifies of what I mean. So for the investors to go and say, hey, you got guys, how are you guys doing? And they're like, yeah, we're doing great. We have 2 billion eyeballs. But they don't have 2 billion eyeballs if potentially what the documentary was saying is that up to half of the freaking accounts on Instagram are probably fake. So imagine dating someone, right? And y'all are getting serious and you know, you're figuring out what their assets look like. And this whole time they've been telling you, oh yeah, I have, you know, $1 million of assets I have $1 million liquid capability. And then you find out they're really $500,000 in debt. And it wasn't really the money. They were just trying to play it off like, oh yeah, that credit, that debt is my money. So I'm like, I'll be damned. Y'all really letting this attention economy get out of hand. Because at this point, if we were to take the credit out, right? If we were to take these fake eyeballs out, would these companies even, what size are they really? What do they really look like? And it's not even a diss. It's not even anything. I'm coming from a place of like, I really want to support y'all. Because when I see these types of bubbles, they collapse. They burst. You know, how high do y'all want to go? So, you know, for all I know, there's a whole team at Facebook and they're super good at getting rid of these bots and making sure this bubble doesn't get too inflamed or whatever. But the documentary, their angle was like, oh, you know, they don't really have any incentive to stop these bots because the bots help them. And I just thought that was so interesting. So I'm sure there's levels of truth on both sides. But just the concept of fake eyeballs in an attention economy, how much more silly can you get? Your attention is the most scarce thing you have. It's the most scarce wealth you have. Why are we trading it? And even more, why are we creating fake ones to further devalue the actual scarce attention we already have? Do y'all understand what I'm saying? It dilutes the value of it. It's the same, like, you know how the more money we print, it devalues the worth of the dollar. You know how they say, oh, you know, don't keep your money in a bank account, it depreciates, inflation. Well, guess what? They inflate in the eyeballs. And apparently mad people do this. Mad influencers do this, celebrities, journalists. There's a whole industry supporting, you know, everybody who wants these fake eyeballs. And get this, people want the fake eyeballs. Wait, hold up. People want the fake eyeballs so they can go to brands and be like, hi, brand. Yeah, I got 100,000 followers. Give me some stuff. I can get you in front of 100,000. This is a brand who started from a hardworking entrepreneur. You know what I mean? Let's say it's you, right? You started this company and boom, so, oh, I got 100,000 people I could put you in front of. And then here you are giving actual wealth, which is whatever your product or service is, and they're going and showing it to credit eyeballs. why y'all do this? Like, we need realness in the economy. Like, if we're just trading credit and we're just diluting, it's already scary enough that the attention economy has got this wide. But y'all have credit eyeballs now and credit engagement and credit, like, likes and comments. It's not even real. Oh, come on. And then you're just making them even richer. So, like, it's just like the deceit is on so many levels. It's like, okay, well, the influencer doesn't really have the influence. The social media platform doesn't really have the freaking people on the social media. What's going on here? Who's trying to really do business and who's just trying to, like, get looks? It's all about the looks. So that's what I wanted to talk about today, which is how superficiality won. How did we get here? The story of the separation of looks and substance. And luckily, a few years ago, I discovered Stuart Ewan, who is an amazing academic who, you know, is off of everybody's radar. But he wrote a book called All Consuming Images. It's in my Amazon bookstore. It's in the media theory pile. Him and a bunch of other cool media theorists are in there. The books are rare. I don't even know if they're available, but I have them listed, okay? I read this book, All Consuming Images, a while back, and this was during my, I don't know, media wake-up call, I guess you could say, when I was trying to be a writer and I realized, oh my God, nobody reads. So he basically, you know, and he's very anti-capitalist. He's very, he hates ads. Most of these people, it's so funny. I go into this world as a marketer and I actually love ads and I love business and all these things and free markets. But I learn from the academics who have this critical point of view because they have an intellectual grasp on these on media consumption that I think marketers should have. Because marketers, you know, it's funny, I'll go on a marketer's page and they'll be like, attention spans are 0.2 seconds. So you should always have this type of image. And I'm like, how could you say that with a straight face? Like, that doesn't terrify you? Like, marketers, they don't really care. Like, they're not paying attention to, not obviously not all marketers, but I'm just saying, like, the general language and how it changes from academic to marketer is marketer will be like, yeah, people need, like, crazy stimulation, so we got to do this now. And no one's wondering, like, that seems concerning. Why is the attention span so short? Wait, so now we got to change the whole strategy of content because the society's attention span is decreasing? Like, wait, hold on. Before we run the campaign, does anyone have questions about how it got to be this way? Okay, so Stuart Ewan, he's great. All his stuff, very, very fascinating. All Consuming Images, it's a very bookish book. So that's why I'm hoping to kind of just summarize it for you if you're not trying to get that academic with it. But what I love about him and Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman and all the other amazing people, Nicholas Carr in my media theory section, is that they all been said this. They all been warned us. Everybody watches Social Dilemma and is like, wow, that's so deep. Oh my God, so deep, right? And I'm like, this has all been theorized to a T. Brave New World was published in the 30s. Hello. Can I get a hallelujah? Y'all want to act like, oh, you know, if, you know, this is just so horrible that it's gotten to this place. No, people were here to try to tell y'all. Aldous Huxley was trying to tell y'all. Alan Watts was trying to tell y'all. But y'all, what's so sick about the whole thing is because so many of us don't have the appetite for the medium that they publish the information, that it might as well not exist. Because what they were trying to say was told in a way that literally can, it has a almost impossible way of being consumed in the media climate. Ugh, this is my frustration, y'all. This is why I gotta make the crazy videos and I gotta post all the selfies and shit on Instagram, because I'm like, look, y'all, you know, y'all were great, but I got to come in here and add some flavor to this because this is just going to sit on this shelf. Okay, so anyway, Stuart Ewan. Oh my God, he's so great. So the basis of this book, it fucked me up, was that the premise is basically that society has turned into a skin. What does that mean? It means that everything, pretty much everything, okay, is a symbol of substance and not the substance itself, okay? I'm gonna break that down. But he talks about how the shift from the agrarian age to the industrial age had the biggest influence on when substance disappeared. Like, the whole book kind of really theorizes in detail how substance evaporated and how culture became okay and satisfied with material things as long as they appeared. Not just material things, emotional things, psychological things, food, everything, money. We were okay if it physically appeared as if it had substance. But no one was really checking to see if it had substance. And that's why this fake eyeballs thing is the perfect example of how, it's the epitome of what it looks like when we no longer care about substance, because the eyeballs that are looking at the things with no substance are not even real. Okay, sorry. It's just so funny to me. So, okay, what caused the separation from form and substance? And let me give you some examples when I say that. Relationships. How many times? We see it all the time. Oh, you know, they look so cute on Instagram, but then what? You hear a story, they hate each other. Somebody hurt somebody, some kind of crazy. You know, it got to a point in my life where the more perfect your life looks on Instagram, the more I don't trust you. The more I know, my heart goes out. My heart goes out to y'all who are really trying to do this perfect Charlotte from Sex and the City situation. That was a great episode, by the way. There's an episode where it's totally relevant to what we're talking about, where Charlotte, she gets featured in a magazine. In one of those wedding magazines, in her perfect Manhattan house, and it's on the day that, you know, she files for divorce or something dramatic like that, but they still take the picture. And what happens? The picture is beautiful, and it circulates in the magazine. And what does it do? Of course, it pressures and inspires other women to think, that's what love looks like. Honey, no. They hate each other. They're filing for a divorce. They snapped a pic. I have a video, my first media theory video on YouTube is called The Effects of Split-Second Communication. Y'all want to turn, do you understand how quick a camera snaps? The next time you're taking a picture of yourself, look how quick that camera snaps. You cannot base a long-term decision or long-term perception off of that split second. Charlotte was in a miserable relationship. The camera snapped over a setting, a facade, a surface. It went cha-ching. And what happens? That image gets circulated and people think that's what love looks like. No. I don't know if you've seen those memes of like all the people who've committed suicide, and it's like, this is what depression looks like. And everybody's smiling. Everybody's laughing. Because the danger of living in a society where everything is about looks and substance is that people think everyone's okay is if they look okay. Whether they were smiling. I mean, look how happy she looks. She looks so beautiful. Beautiful people don't get sad. You know, people who have lots of followers, they don't get sad. Okay. All right. I mean, and that was the sad, like, commentary that was coming from the people in this documentary, is that they were all aspiring to be the image of whatever Charlotte they saw on Instagram, because they truly believe that once you captured that pachow, that you're good. That pachow ain't shit, especially now. Maybe the pachow was something back then when the camera was big as hell and you had to sit there for 15 minutes for the film to develop, because that means you had to be, you know, kind of doing well for yourself to be even taking a picture. But y'all really got it messed up out here. Okay. So that's one example of a separation between form and substance. How many times you been on a date? The person look fine. Ooh, they got their hair done, looking good, smelling good. They're an idiot. Can't have a conversation. It doesn't, you know, it's just, y'all not going to click. That's form over substance. I have a whole episode, money versus wealth. That's another perfect example. Money is substance. You go, you check your bank account, by the way, which is nothing but pixels on a screen. Most of us don't have hordes of cash sitting in the house, and even if we do, that's another form. It's not the substance. The substance is the wealth. So, and then the big one is in Zen, right? I talk about how the whole freeing idea of Zen for me is that it's not about paying attention to symbols at all. It's not about any, it's really about erasing any symbol, every word, every image, every projection, every dream, giving yourself some time to just experience reality for what it is. So that's another example of form over substance. Some people don't know that there's a difference between water and the word water. You cannot get wet with the word water. Okay? Do y'all hear what I'm saying? You cannot get wet with the word water. You cannot explain water. You can only experience water. Okay? You can only experience life. But half of us are going around living lives trying to turn water into words. More accurately, turn water into pictures. How do I look? How do we make everything look this way? And let me tell you, as a writer, I was infuriated after I finished this book because I realized, oh shit, it's all gonna come down to how I look? And the answer is yes. Luckily, I'm a marketer and I can embrace it, but I know for a lot of artists, that's where the trail ends. They're like, I'm out. All right. Artists, the whole point of being an artist is for substance. The whole point is to feel substance. That's why they hate in the climate we're in now. Because the artists who win, the quote-unquote artists who win, don't have no substance. How come this person got a deal? How come this person is getting a Grammy? Because they focus on form. They focus on looks. It doesn't have to be good. Hard to hear, I know. You don't need talent. There's a reason why Kim Kardashian took off in this era. Because she looks like that. She knows. She don't need nobody to tell her that. She was comfortable with the lack of substance. She said, this actually works for me. Right? Then you got the Jasmine Sullivans of the world. Then you got the talented people of the world who everybody's like, damn, why don't people pay attention to them? Because that's not the measuring stick we use today, y'all. We don't use talent measuring stick. Not enough for it to hit the mainstream. And if so, it's not going to happen at the same speed. Another thing I forgot to mention in a previous episode when I was talking about the evolution of fame is that one thing you'll notice, especially with a lot of black artists, is after the television was invented, a lot of the talented singers who didn't fit the standard of what was beautiful on television, they disappeared. You'll see it. If you look at the catalogs of music and the billboards of music between like the 40s and 50s to the 60s, all of a sudden everybody's skinny and light skinned. All of a sudden, I mean, that was one of the scandals with the Supremes. I don't know the exact details, but you know, they made Dreamgirls, and that was going into that story. You sound good, but girl, we don't think you look good. People, Neil Postman theorized that JFK won because television was popular. So you have to understand that vision and image is the measuring stick. what looks is the measuring stick. So Stuart Ewan in this book, he talks about, you know, what caused this. And this is pretty much the theory. The theory is that high-class people forever have always hoarded a lot of wealth, right? They want a lot of gold and jewels and spices and books and rare things and taxidermy. And so it was unheard of for working class people, middle class people to have any of that, to have any, you know, special artifacts or wealth or anything like that. But after the Industrial Revolution, the whole point was that you could produce things at a mass scale. And so there was a demand for working class people to have artifacts and things that could be perceived as kind of like wealthy things. And this could be little stuff. It doesn't have to be like a taxidermy cheetah hanging on the wall. It could be just a pretty pot or, you know, a nice lamp or, you know, a piece of clothing that looks really fancy but isn't H&M. That demand was able to be fulfilled in the industrial age because people figured out how to mass produce stuff. We were mass producing cars, we were mass producing steel, we were mass producing everything. I think this book even talks about how, like, just like the pen being mass produced was a big deal. The fact that you could just buy a ballpoint pen, the story of Bic, super fascinating, look into it, by the way. That was like, wow, there's like mass producive stuff. Today it's the exact opposite. Today the artisan market is thriving because it has gotten to the point where things are so well at being produced at a mass market that I could live in New York and you can live in LA and we can go to Target and buy literally the same thing. We can probably go down the street and we will see the same franchises, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Chick-fil-A, Target, Walmart. We have gotten so good that you almost don't even know where the hell you at. You could be in New Jersey, you could be in Florida. You won't really know. And so we're kind of fatigued with the mass production that now we're like, let me go on Etsy. Let me buy from this boutique. Let me buy something that is one of one because everybody might have this. But anyway, before all this, you have to understand that it was a luxury to be able to go to the store and see a bunch of different affordable, because the thing is like, yeah, you could have gotten a pen, but it was harder to find and it was going to be more expensive because it was probably being made by some kind of special pen person, you know? And so, you know, Ford kind of pioneering the assembly line and just this idea of efficiency. I have that episode about time, and how time was invented and refined in the Industrial Revolution because people started seeing, okay, how much can we get in an hour? And depending on how much we can get in an hour, we can figure out what the wage can be and what everything will make, you know, how things will make sense economically. So people started to make things that reminded the working class people of what high class people do, you know, what rich people do, which is kind of like have decorative, stylistic items in their home. Again, this could be kitchenware, this can be clothing, this could be decoration. Just the variety was exciting and the affordability was, I mean, that is the most American thing ever because that really shaped where we are now. Dior has a great autobiography. I've mentioned it before, and he noticed very early how American women were less interested in having quality handmade dresses and had preferred to have a couple less well-made dresses because the Industrial Revolution really pushed quantity as a status. Whereas in European countries, they weren't making factories, you know, the Industrial Revolution happened here, right? So they adopted it. They took a lot of this stuff, but it's not in their blood. It's not in their roots to always want mass produced stuff. They, to this day, have a culture that's more influenced by what we would call slow economics. But again, the term slow economics is a facade, because it's not slow. We're just fast. It's how long shit takes, right? But to the American mind, it's slow because we're so used to the quick two-day shipping Amazon package. So, and you'll find this to this day, I'm sure you got a grandma, auntie, somebody in your family who was like, it's about quality, dear. It's not about quantity. And the irony is that, well, it's not really an irony, but the quality stuff lasts. You know, quality clothes last 10 years, if not a lifetime, depending on the quality, or just quality things, right? Quality furniture, quality shoes. A lot of these things were, before the Industrial Revolution, they were designed to be repaired. They were not designed to be thrown away. If you go to the mall today, the one that might still exist in your neighborhood, everything in that mall, I hate to break it to you, is designed to be thrown away eventually. Everything on the rack, everything on the shelves, everything is designed to be thrown out. Alan Watts says, America's on a mission to turn the world's resources into junk as quickly as possible. You know, and it's really crazy. So Stuart Ewan was basically saying that the idea that a lot of things, stylistic things in my home, can give me the perceived, can give me the perception that I'm high class, you know, like the high class, that was fulfilled. That demand was fulfilled in crazy ways. And what happened was, retailers found that they can satisfy their customers by producing things with less quality, but as long as it looked like, as long as it looked expensive or looked like it was worth some money, that was enough. And what an idea. Another great documentary, I'm going to link to it. Hopefully it's still up on YouTube. You know how that goes sometimes. Is the story of Zara. Who child? If you want an economics lesson, watch that documentary, because the founder of Zara, who is Spanish, and that whole thing came from Spain, he is the epitome of someone who fulfilled demand in clothing. Right. Some people did it in homeware. Some people did it with cars. Some people did it with electronics. He did it with clothing. And he did, I believe, starting in the 20s. And he would steal, honey. Oh, he would steal. Dior and all them hated him because somehow he would get leaks of what the big fashion houses were making. And he would reproduce it for cheap, which is literally what they still do to this day. And they not only steal from the big houses now, but they steal from boutiques, styles and things from boutiques, and they make a killing. And the clothes, they look good for like the first day, maybe the second time you wear it, but quickly the fabric will fall. It will, the dyes will come out. You know, you're not getting your Dior experience. And unfortunately, that has killed fashion. It killed it. YSL has a great quote where he says something like, fashion died in the 70s or something like that. Like, the real industry of fashion died. And you know, he's right. Because if you are a service provider, right, if you are creating something with your hands that is not meant to be made in a factory, you cannot compete with the factory. Sound familiar? Are you going through this on some level in your life? Yeah, we all are. We all are. That's why these influencers are buying bots that serve the company that has put them at a disadvantage to begin with. So I'm just like, somebody help me, you know? So yeah, style was democratized, and it was the democratization of style where you start to see the split between substance and form. And he has this freaking great picture in here in this book of brownstones, I believe in Harlem or in New York. And you know, the front of brownstones are very detailed. You know, they have detailed trimmings and detailed stairs, and they're really beautiful. It's so funny because today we look at these brownstones and we're like, man, things used to be made with so much care and love, and they still look brand new, a lot of them in New York. But the image he has here on the side of the building, I'll really try to link to it. It might be a shitty picture, I'm just letting you know, but I think it'll help in general. On the side of the brownstones is just a big gray wall. The brownstones are all connected, right? But the one that's sticking out on the corner of the sidewalk, the side of it is not detailed at all. It's just a wall. It's just it's just a big slab of concrete. This effed me up when I saw this. He says, this is a good mind, man, to see that. From the street, each house is a unique tribute to a different historical period and source. And that's true. Brownstones are deeply inspired from a lot of European architecture, I believe a lot of Dutch architecture, and very craftsman-focused people, you know, from Europe who were building those things with their bare hands. Okay, so he says, from the side, as is evident in the picture, we see that these architectural motifs are simply an overlay to a shared structure. Recently, some postmodern architects have turned the concept of the facade into an explicit architectural element, a humorous visual commentary. He has an artist who, I guess it's a postmodern architect. I'll make sure there's a picture of this too. And basically the building looks like it's peeling, like that gray slab looks like it's peeling off the wall intentionally. It's kind of like a surreal thing. and he's guessing that it's kind of like a commentary on the lack of substance. So the point is, like, that is the metaphor. The brownstone being really pretty on the front, but being a slab of concrete on the side, that's everything. He's saying, yeah, everything looks good. Everything looks like it has been, you know, taken care of. But if you flip it on the underbelly, you got a mess. You don't even have a mess. You have the most economic kind of like the cheapest thing you can have. Meaning like no effort was put into the substance, because we are a culture where we have yet to see why having substance could be cool. generally, right? I'm sure a lot of us want substance. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you're a substance kind of person. I feel like my audience has always been substance people. Y'all share my frustration. But I'm telling y'all, people are buying fake eyeballs. The company is using a fake to get the other symbol, right? So we're using symbols to get symbols. We're using form to get form. We're using surface to get surface. We're using looks to get looks. We're not using this stuff to get substance. You don't give someone credit so that they can give you just credit. People get credit so they build infrastructure, to build substance, wealth. Wealth. We have the capacity and the technology and the skill set to build wealth and infrastructure. What are we doing? Okay. Want to close this out talking about Goodhart's Law. I bring Goodhart's Law up in my documentary. Goodhart's Law. It's basically a law that says anything you try to measure will in effect be warped by the fact that you're trying to measure it. So, people are trying to measure likes and eyeballs and those things, followers. But because we're trying to measure that, it changes what we're measuring, okay? It warps what that metric actually means because you were trying to measure it. What a beautiful concept. Why? Because it tells you that no matter what you try to measure, the fact that you are measuring it makes it liable for the wrong incentives to happen. I understand we went into this with our intentions being good. We wanted the internet was this great, oh my God, we can do all this stuff. We can upload all this entertainment. Okay. But y'all, we did not think about how these metrics were going to ultimately be meaningless, y'all. What is the point of fake eyeballs? Please explain that to me. We already live in a mostly superficial society. And we got fake eyeballs looking at the superficialness. That is like a superficial, like, infinity right there. Can we back up now? Can we back up and be like, okay, where is the substance? Can we do better business? That was my point about attention for sale. Can we just, don't we all want to live here and have decent lives? No matter, yeah, we might have different views, we might have different beliefs, but I'm pretty sure we can all agree that we want this planet and we want our societies to be places where we could at least live decent lives. Well, how can we do that if we continue to pursue superficiality to this point? What is underneath it? Is it meant to last? Like, you get what I'm saying? Like, what's underneath everything? Not to say, oh, you know, everything got to be exposed. And no, but just, is there integrity beneath the look? You know, do you understand how many people who have substance will be discouraged? They don't even care. It's not like people don't want to have substance. It's that people who have substance are being pushed economically for their livelihood, y'all. Not just morally, not just, you know, it's not a moral decision. It's for people's livelihood now. People gotta, you know, look a certain way to get a yes. I do think looks matter, but I clearly don't think they matter more than everything. Yes, looks are great. Yeah, I love eyesight and visuals. Cool. But my point here is we might have gone a little too far. I don't know. That's just me. We might have gone a little too far. And the form was supposed to represent the substance. You know, it was supposed to, there was a time, I shouldn't say it was supposed to, there was a time when the form was an expression of the substance. You know, if you saw someone and you know, if you saw a product and it appeared as good quality, it was. Now you gotta be on, you know, on guard with everything and everybody. Everything's just waiting to fall apart. You buy a piece of furniture, you're just waiting for the thing to fall apart. You start dating somebody, you're just waiting for the thing to fall apart. You know, it's just like, what's going on here? Substance, what you can't see. Ooh, I'll end with this. Substance, the etymology. Stance, to stand. Under, what is under your stance? What is under your posture, the way you appear? And again, I'm not saying, oh, we gotta all tell each other everything. No, I think part of the beauty is privacy, right? Of course. But is the thing gonna fall apart? Are you falling in love with an IKEA chair? You know, this whole economy is running on IKEA chairs right now. No funny. All right, cool. Well, that was the story of the separation of form and substance. Please let me know what you thought of this episode. You can write me a message, email me, tweet me. This book is so good, y'all. Stuart Ewan, I honestly don't even know if he's still alive, because guess what? Because he's not visually focused, no one even knows where this man at. So wherever you are, thank you for your work. Thank you to all the academics who write things that only the weirdos like me and you read. And, you know, I'm with you in this in wanting to pursue your substance. I know it's not easy, but, you know, the marketer in me says, read the climate, you know, read the media climate, make it work for you. And just because looks run everything doesn't mean that substance isn't valued when it's felt. So whatever you're working on, you know, I definitely am very proud and have a lot of respect for the people who still care about that. So, all right, y'all. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.